Hi, folks. Welcome back. This week on the podcast, we're going to be talking about a subject that on its surface might not seem like it has a lot of intersections with folks who have a future interest in healthcare. We're going to sort of break apart what those intersections are, what the implications for practice, what we've seen historically, what's happened topically. And specifically, we're going to focus in on gun violence. You know, we've heard it called a public health issue, and it is very much that. And so that's how we're going to be treating it in this conversation today. We're going to be really framing it as a public health issue, implications for future care providers and practitioners, and how you can start to construct your own thoughts and philosophy around this for the future. So buckle up for a really great episode. And welcome back to the Pre-Health Podcast at Penn State, the show to help all pre-health students on their journeys to acceptance. I am your host this week, John Moses Bronson. My friend and colleague, Kimberly Johnson, continues to be out on leave, but we are wishing all the best of luck and for some peace, quiet, and solitude as she has two very young bebés at home. So we're going to wish her the best of luck, but we are thankfully, once again, joined by our friend of the podcast, our friend in real life, Dr. Michelle Meckel. Welcome back.
Thank you, John. It is an honor and a joy to be here and to hang out with you. Woo-hoo. So thank you.
So I think we're back for, I think, of the topics that we've discussed so far in sort of like this ethics series, certainly one that on its surface doesn't seem the most tied together. And as we sort of talked about in the teaser for the episode, you know, we're really seeing gun violence, gun deaths as a really large public health issue. So to sort of get us started, can you sort of give us a nice sort of little like overview of where we're at, what we're looking at, why we should be concerned about this?
Absolutely. So as you said, gun violence is a real public health issue, and it's one that is escalating today. We have had approximately two a day mass shootings since the beginning of this year alone.
Yeah.
And when we talk about mass shootings, we talk about where there are approximately four individuals involved at least. Mm-hmm. So that tells you that the numbers in general are much higher than that when we start considering ones or twos, right?
Yeah.
Now, there are approximately 400 million guns in circulation in the United States.
That we know about.
That we know of. That are have come through the system in a legitimate way. We're not talking about bioprinted, 3D printed guns or the
things
like.
Through black market, those
absolutely,
sorts of things.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have 85,000 injuries a year and approximately 50,000 deaths a year. Mm-hmm. These firearm deaths are entirely preventable.
Yeah.
And among those deaths, we see suicide as actually the higher number than murder. Many of us think when we think about gun violence of killings or murder of others, but really suicide is the number one risk here.
Yeah. And I think to sort of like get this episode sort of started off, we're really going to be framing today's conversation. And, you know, we talked a little bit beforehand so that we were on the same page. We're really going to look at this through the lens of this being a uniquely American problem. And as a result, like, we're not going to get too much into the weeds on like what some other countries have done, because culturally we have a very different relationship with firearms than, say, like, you know, a lot of people like to point at Australia, and what Australia did was wonderful, but their previous relationship with guns was very different, right? And so we need to take that into account. And so, you know, as we have this discussion, sort of think about implications for the future, we're going to try our best to really think about this unique American problem and sort of look at what's sort of best culturally for the United States when we are having this discussion. So if you're listening from other countries, hey, that's great and wonderful. We're really going to be looking at this through a cultural lens.
Absolutely. In fact, the Second Amendment protects the right to keep and bear arms.
Exactly.
And that was one of the founding premises of our country. And that has continued, both not just through the Constitution, but through case law and through statutes. Whereas there are only 10 states, for example, that are willing to ban assault weapons, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very politicized issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's completely understandable. So whereas in many instances, a solution is we need to cull or remove X from, you know, use, mm-hmm. that's not a solution in this particular issue in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, if we think of like a parallel, if we think about sort of like controlling certain populations of pest populations, we can't completely eliminate them. They're sort of part, there's part of the ecosystem, right? If we remove guns, it creates this vacuum and we don't really know what like replaces it. And it's not a feasible solution to the problem, because much like trying to intentionally eradicate a large species, it's a lot easier said than done.
Absolutely. And this is a problem in the context of increasing gun ownership mm-hmm. currently, and also in a highly, hotly politicized environment mm-hmm. on this topic. This tends to be a third rail topic that as we talk about.
Can you explain to our listeners sort of like what that term third rail means? Because like, I am familiar, but also like I move in certain circles, right?
Right. And I apologize for the throat clearing or any of that. It's for me, allergy season now. So a third rail issue is an issue where voters will take action on that issue alone. Mm-hmm. They will not look at the candidate's platform. They will simply say, where do they stand on X, Y, or Z? And then they will take action on that stance alone. Gun ownership tends to be that. Abortion tends to be that. We've seen a number of issues, like gay marriage was one of those issues. We see those issues arise frequently in the United States, mm-hmm. and they are polarizing.
Yeah. It's something that sort of elicits this very deep response in people. And so it feels like an attack on a piece of their identity. And so, you know, I see where that preference, that hard preference comes from like a sociological standpoint.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is a recent Pew report showed that the majority of Americans do favor some sort of stricter gun control, mm-hmm. but it's so politicized, mm-hmm. gun ownership is growing, and it is a third rail issue, so we don't see traction mm-hmm. because we see people, candidates, being positioned either for or against in a very hard line. There's very little willingness to compromise on these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like, you know, we certainly are seeing this. I'll be honest, if we've sort of seen this for like we're getting close to 20 years now in our government, where like there's no room for compromise anymore. There is full wins or complete losses. And unfortunately, I think that for better or for worse, I think that just creates more losers than winners.
Absolutely. And the sad part is the most vulnerable mm-hmm. are the ones who end up being the losers in those circumstances.
Yeah.
You had mentioned how this is not an equal opportunity healthcare crisis. And most of our healthcare crises are not equal opportunity. They impact marginalized groups far more mm-hmm. than they do wealthy, educated individuals.
Yeah. So I recently traveled to Philadelphia with a group of students to sort of like learn about social determinants of health in sort of a real applied personal way. And on one of the days we went to a technical high school within Philadelphia, and in talking with a school administrator, they shared that they had like put out a survey, and, you know, I had referenced this in our previous episode on long COVID and how a vast majority of them knew someone who had died from COVID. In that same survey, they found that every single student that responded to the survey knew a family member or close family friend that had died as a result of gun violence. And so, you know, if you were to put that same survey out at Penn State, for example, we wouldn't be nearly in that sort of like proportion. Not even close.
Correct. Not even close. We know that it is much more likely for African Americans to be victims of gun violence.
Yeah.
Like to the tune of 4 times more likely.
Yeah. It's a huge percentage, right? And where do we see more sort of like intensely populated groups of that population together? It tends to be in inner cities, whereas which is sort of an epicenter for a lot of gun violence. And I think there's a lot of sort of like urban like ethics and sort of urban sort of like sociology that's at play there. And like, we really don't have time to go into all of that, but it, you know, it's sort of this unfortunate symptom of these bigger problems. But today we're going to be talking about this one particular symptom. Mm-hmm. So just really want to provide context for our listeners.
And then let's add one more thing to that, and that's money.
Yeah.
And by money, I mean the gun lobby, mm-hmm. The NRA, entities like that have a lot of political power.
Yeah.
They have a lot of political clout. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of financial resources, and they are willing to use those resources to move the legislative and legal needle in their favor. In fact, we saw in 1996, there's a very famous amendment called the Dickey Amendment. And the Dickey Amendment basically said that no funds for injury prevention can be used to advocate for gun control. And that was put on the federal agencies. And so we saw, for example, the FDA and other entities being like, oh, well, we can't do research or fund research in those arenas because of this amendment. And he was very well funded by and a very big proponent for and an ally of the gun lobby, mm-hmm. like the NRA.
Yeah, so we have these sort of like weird historical things that are affecting sort of our capacity to do broader interventions that we think about, right? And so sort of acknowledging that that sort of like stuff is not feasible, where do we see sort of our ability to influence and impact this, for lack of a better term, epidemic?
So there are some opportunities. There are, in fact, many opportunities. Mm-hmm. We can look at safety training. Mm-hmm. We can look at education. Mm-hmm. We can look at storage, and I'll tell you a story about storage here as we go forward. We can look at gatekeeping in terms of who gets guns. Now, that mm-hmm. is a fraught issue in and of itself.
Sure. It's interesting to me, though, like, we certainly do control that to a certain extent, but I feel like we control voting more than we control gun ownership. And it feels like those things should sort of go hand in hand, although I think that, like, controlling voting is problematic as well. But, you know, in terms of, like, in a comparison thing, someone cannot use their vote to advocate for their needs, but they can own a firearm. And again, there's a lot of cultural reasons for that, but it feels like this odd sort of like comparison point.
Right. And unfortunately, we see both of these hitting marginalized populations, right? Mm-hmm. We see a lot of redistricting issues that are arguably gerrymandering issues, where we are cherry-picking populations for who they would vote for, whether it be the party, positionality, et cetera, et cetera, and therefore the makeup of that population. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of voter control laws go in regarding identification and poll opening hours and mail-in ballots, again, disproportionately targeting marginalized voters who may not operate on the same schedules or have access to the same resources that more affluent folks do. So it's all of these things do point in the same direction, very, very dangerously and concerningly.
Oh, yeah, it's it feels like almost like too much. So, like, you know, the population for this podcast is really sort of students sort of in their exploration phase. So what are sort of the things that people who are thinking about this, where should they be, where should we be directing them to sort of like start unpacking this for themselves?
So those who are going into medicine and are on that path, or those who are in medicine already, have an amazing position of power to make a difference in this issue if they choose to exercise it. Okay. So, for example, they can be active in advocacy because they have a voice, they have a respected voice. Mm-hmm. And so advocacy on this issue is critical. Research for those who are going into a more academic path of medicine. Often academic medical centers are located in urban areas. And so there's an opportunity for research on this particular issue, in particular as a public health crisis. But for everyone going into medicine who plans to have a patient population, education. Mm-hmm. Education is key in this arena. Mm-hmm. But that also requires having conversations with your patients. And a lot of providers might have a little fear of entering a conversation about this with their patients. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, providers already enter a lot of muddy water in conversations with their patients. Yeah. They ask about sexual conduct. Mm-hmm. Right? Because we need to be concerned about STIs, particularly in an era of resistance to treatment, right?
Yeah.
We also ask about drinking and how many drinks people, you know, consume a week, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. We talk and binge drinking, et cetera, et cetera. We talk about eating habits. What is your diet? Eating habits of concern there might be with a patient. We talk about drug use, right? Yeah. Which is an illicit
activity.
Yes, exactly. But yet we have those discussions, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about all of these things. We talk about smoking,
mental health.
Exactly. Depression.
It's a
anxiety.
Required question.
Absolutely.
And they charge you money to ask it.
Yeah, see, there you go. So this could also appear.
Yeah.
On that list of questions without any concern. The concern arises when there's a position taken, mm-hmm. right, by the provider. But in asking the question, this is a question just like any other risk question out there. And just like if you said on your questionnaire that you drink more than an allotted number of drinks per day, two per day or whatever, or that you are engaged in illicit drug use, the provider will be triggered to talk to you mm-hmm. about treatment options, about mm-hmm. cutting down, about all sorts
how
of...
How you intervene.
Exactly.
Yeah, because what we're talking about is sort of like preventative care. And all of those questions arose because having that conversation in a sort of pre... situation before something more serious results allows us, and I use a royal us, not of me personally, but it allows us as healthcare providers to be able to intervene on behalf of our patient, to advocate to them for their health, and to just think about their lifestyle choices a little bit differently. You know, the goal, as I hope we've made it clear, is not to discourage those things, but to talk about how those things are integrated into their lifestyle. Are they being safe, right? Because alcohol on its own is not a dangerous thing, but the way that you use it can be dangerous. You know, we think a lot about, you know, and in our country, marijuana is still a Schedule One, right? So it's still like viewed as like a certain way. But when we prescribe that as a medication, we don't talk about not using it. It's about how the ways in which you use it. And so I think that's really sort of the framing of this conversation. And I think it can be very challenging to bring it up because of that politicization. That's a hard word. It really is. But, you know, I want to encourage people who might be thinking like, I'm not going to talk about that in a clinical environment, that like, no, this is like a huge part of preventative care. And when you sort of back it up to these like four pillars of medical ethics, you know, you want to do things that have beneficence to your patients. And this is something that can really provide some benefits. You're not telling people not to have guns, but to put the proper things in place, that education. If you are a future provider and you think of yourself as an educator and advocate for your future patients, but you don't want to talk about this, that's really a huge gap.
Right. And you have to talk to your patients about lots of things that make you uncomfortable and make them uncomfortable, right? Yeah. And again, you're not talking about abstinence here. Mm-hmm. You're going to share with them resources for safe storage, for gun locks, for how we store, how we keep, who has access to, do they have training, all of those questions, not questions about, oh, well, you shouldn't have a gun, right? Even if that's your personal positionality, right? Knowing it's their right to have a gun as long as they haven't, you know, hit any of the preemptions to the Second Amendment for ownership, then it's not about you shouldn't. It's more about how can you do this safely if this is your decision to do this, right? So you can recognize autonomy at the same time that you help engage in beneficence and non-maleficence.
Yeah. I mean, to sort of put it in like a similar sort of like analogy, like a provider who is like devoutly Catholic talking to a patient about birth control or about sort of like, you know, sexual health options, you know, those things are still choices that your patients can be making, and you have a responsibility to fully educate them and to not let your personal opinions intersect with your professional guidance as a provider. And that can be a difficult line to walk, but, you know, if you can think of it in a way of like, this patient's going to make this choice whether I approve of it or not, and I have a responsibility to just like help them think about this differently, it is very similar. So we're not asking a group of providers to do anything that we haven't asked other providers to do in other sort of circumstances.
Absolutely. And this can lead to interventions such as some emergency rooms, for example. This is one of their questions, you know, do you have guns in the home? Right? Yeah. Or do you have a gun in the home? And if the answer is yes, they automatically offer that individual a gun lock and some educational materials.
Yeah.
And it's done in a very non-judgmental, non-invasive manner, the same way that if you ever are at a sexual health clinic, right? There are condoms available in the office settings, everywhere, because they're simply encouraging safe exercises.
Well, and so like to sort of like continue this parallel a little bit more, like in the comparison with sexual health, like ideally you would sort of adjust your advice depending on the identity and lived experience of that patient, right? So like, you're not going to talk about sexual health in the same way to a woman that engages with sex with another woman as you would with a woman who engages with sex with a man, right? That sex looks very different. And so you have to sort of adjust your advice and your guidance based on that. By the same token, like, gun ownership looks differently. Like, the uses for gun ownership, whether it is for, you know, hunting and providing, whether it is for sport and pleasure, whether it is for, like, self-protection, like, those are all valid reasons for people to choose gun ownership. But the way in which you protect yourself and others will also similarly, like, differentiate there.
Right. If you know your patient and you know that they either have their own small children in the house or they have grandchildren in the house, right? You know that they love those children, right, by nature. And so you might encourage this as protection for those individuals, for those third parties, right? And that's just part of the education. So that's a way in with the patient, yeah, into the discussion.
Yeah, and I think that there's going to be this fear of like, well, what if I get an extreme reaction from a patient in one way or another, right? Because there, again, this is it's a cultural thing. And so there's a lot of perhaps like assumed intent behind the questions. And so, you know, the importance of relationship building and sort of like doing that work, which we know to be so super important in healthcare and admittedly has like been affected by like demand and by, you know, an unfortunate number of professionals in the field leaving, especially during COVID. I know personally that this is not an easy thing to ask, but I think it is a necessary thing to ask. Like, nobody at the time was like, I think, like super thrilled to like require that like depressive symptoms question, but the power that that intervention has provided, there's lots of data to show that that, although I don't think we should be charging for it, but the inclusion of that question has really provided great benefit to a lot of patients.
And those two questions, this question and that question, are directly linked when we know that most of the gun deaths are due to suicide.
Yeah.
Where there's a gun in the home. So these two are very linked. And just like you're asking all these other questions, if you place this question among those other questions and make it very unbiased, mm-hmm, you reduce the likelihood of having that extreme reaction.
Yeah.
I'm sure that providers get extreme reactions to all of these screening questions, mm-hmm, that they ask, whether it be about mental health, whether it be about sexual conduct, whether it be about use of alcohol or drugs, mm-hmm, or smoking. But if we ask all of those questions, we ask them all in an unbiased way and all with the same approach, yeah, right? Then we have less likelihood of that. In fact, there is a project called the Bullet Points Project, mm-hmm, and that helps providers think about how to talk about this, mm-hmm, issue in particular with their patients. And one of the recommendations is this is just like any of the other often charged preventive questions you're going to be asking.
Yeah.
And it's all in how you ask it and how you place it into context.
Yeah. And it's not like we're going to like try and shove you into this question without any guidance. Like, this is part of what your medical education is going to do. But also, like, you know, so I've toured many medical schools at this point in my career, right? It's part of the job of being a pre-health advisor. Like, a lot of them will have simulation clinics where you do sort of like standardized patient simulators. If these are not part of your standard procedure, your standard questions, this is an opportunity to advocate for that and to say, I think we should be teaching our providers how to ask this question, how to ask it meaningfully, right? Because, you know, I think about how this question might be handled in sort of like a white rural environment, right? Where a greater proportion of gun ownership is really more in the like hunting and sporting category. Whereas, you know, I'm thinking about students at Temple who run a free clinic for the people of North Philadelphia. Gun ownership has a very different role socially there. And so how does that affect that conversation? You know, so it's going to be institution specific, like what that looks like, the intent of that question, how you move forward with it. I think, you know, we've talked about this important role of advocacy. So it's not just asking the question, but saying we need to know what to do as providers in this community, what to do with the answers that we receive, right? If we are hearing from someone that like there is a history of mental illness and there's a history of suicide and depression and alcohol abuse and gun ownership, we have to have a very be able to have the conversation, not about you're not responsible enough to have a gun, which whether we feel that way or not is not our decision. But it's like, if you're going to have a gun and these other things are intersecting, these are the steps that you need to take.
And that then opens the door to issues of A, third-party protections, and B, gatekeeping.
Yeah.
Because sometimes if enough of those questions might line up. Mm-hmm. Like if someone is coming to the provider because of suicidal ideation, mm-hmm, and depression, mm-hmm, and they answer yes to a gun ownership, mm-hmm, question, and we know that males are more likely to use that mechanism than females, and let's say they're male, mm-hmm, then we might start being concerned about needing to do an intervention, right? Mm-hmm. Such as for involuntary commitment or wellness checks, mm-hmm, where we have the police do a wellness check. Now, that is also very, very fraught, mm-hmm, right? Because if you turn a patient in for that, meaning that you have the police engaged, mm-hmm, the likelihood that that patient comes back to you is again
significantly
much lower.
If they see any provider again,
exactly, correct. And if they do, whether they'll be willing to see that person for those issues that they were very open and trusting with you about, right?
Yeah.
Then that also drops significantly.
Yeah, I like this is sort of like taking me back to my time in my career where I worked in residence life. And I remember one situation in particular where I had to do an involuntary commitment of a student that was having a really difficult time. Like, I'm not going to pretend like that was an easy choice. And, you know, in hindsight, I wish I would have responded sooner, but I knew the implications of what that choice meant. And so I don't, you know, I'm not saying this is someone who's never had to think about this. I'm saying this is someone who's had to do it in a past role. It's not an easy choice to make, and you're going to wish you'd made different choices every time. But doing something about it, or at least thinking about it and having that discussion and doing that reflection, is so incredibly important.
And healthcare providers have to make those kind of decisions every single day.
Yeah.
And this is just one more of those hard choices that falls on the healthcare provider's plate. And this is another reason why healthcare providers are really uncomfortable with the gatekeeping role, because as I noted, there's the advocacy, mm-hmm, the research, the education, but then also the gatekeeping aspects, mm-hmm, of involvement. Providers in medical school don't get training on how to assess if someone is fit or unfit for gun ownership,
yeah,
right?
It's not in the standard curriculum. You're right. Not going to see that.
And therefore, providers are really uncomfortable, mm-hmm, with that role.
Yeah.
And they're even uncomfortable with taking that role where they are a reporter, right? Mm-hmm. Because again, they know what it means for that patient-provider relationship and other opportunities to help that patient.
Yeah.
But sometimes those are the right decisions to make.
Yeah, it's difficult because by creating like a gatekeeping function of a helping profession, it shifts the relationship to being an advocate and a sister and an educator, a provider, to being an adversary.
Absolutely.
It complicates the role of a role that is already wildly intersectional and difficult into something that I think it would be, in my personal opinion, I think just not nearly impossible to do well across the board.
Absolutely. And so many providers are really uncomfortable with that. And now some providers might be very comfortable with that. But by and large, they're very uncomfortable with that. But just like we make providers mandatory reporters for many things, by law, they're actually mandatory reporters under a line of cases called Tarasoff, where you would know of a risk to an identifiable third party, and that risk is imminent, highly dangerous. And so it's really something we've put on providers in many, many ways. And this is not their first or the first foray into doing that with gun ownership, right? Because if we have someone, for example, under Tarasoff, who has threatened to kill a very specific person in a specific way, and is clearly intending to do this from how they express
has
themselves.
The means.
Exactly.
Got means and motive.
Right. Then we do owe a duty to third parties, not just our own patient. So we're really putting providers in a difficult position, but they are already in a special position in our society, right? They've gotten this specialized education. They get these specialized insights. They take an oath to first do no harm, but then also to do good. And this is just, sadly, one of those other areas where that's expected.
Yeah. It is further complicating the role, but I hope that we are preparing the next generation of providers to take this on in a way that does not feel overwhelming to them. You know, exposure and repetition is one of our greatest teachers. And so, if you've been practicing for 30 years and we're like, hey, you got to do this, it's like, what? But if we start teaching you from the beginning, if we integrate it into doctoring classes, which is a huge part of every curriculum, of how to do this, not just how to take a proper patient history, but how to do these proper preventative medical questions and how to handle these conversations and the breadth of responses that can be had, we're better preparing the next generation for this is just part of standard practice.
Right. And as it becomes standard practice, the reactions go down dramatically because you come to expect that when you go to the provider.
Yep.
Right? So what is an anomaly today? Because when I first obviously started going to physicians, they didn't ask about things such as your sexual activity, your alcohol use, your drug use.
They didn't want
to know. Exactly. They didn't ask any of that. They might have asked a smoking question, right? But now we're used to being asked about a huge variety of things. And so our reactivity as patients is much lower as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because, you know, I imagine, especially like back in the 80s, like any questions about sexual activity comes very charged, you know, especially, you know, that's the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis. And so, you know, that was probably a very uncomfortable question for providers to ask, you know. Admittedly, we are like 40 years out from the start of that crisis at this point, but that question still has some charge behind it, but not, it's gone way down. And also, like, there's just providers who are naturally better at it.
Absolutely.
And that's the same with everything. You know, we think of end of life care. There are just doctors that are just like not skilled at that. And we have doctors who are wonderfully skilled at asking those questions.
And you bring up an excellent point, because maybe if you are uncomfortable asking some of these questions, your position is perhaps not best selected as primary care.
Yeah.
Right? Or community care, or even emergency care. Right.
Yeah.
You might do far better in a specialty where things are not triggered by many or any of these questions.
Yeah.
Or when somebody's already asked the questions for you by the time you see the patient.
Yeah.
So it's a real thing to reflect on, because I think that today the issue is, among other issues, gun ownership, right? Mm-hmm. But tomorrow it will be something else, and then something else, and then something else. And so it's not about a specific question, but about being able to communicate and engage with your patients.
Meeting them where they're at.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not a universal skill for all physicians, nor should you expect it of yourself if you don't have that. Now, if you're like, oh, but I really want to do primary care, but this makes me nervous, start having that conversation with people you know. A surprising number of people in your circles are gun owners, right? We might not necessarily think of like some of our colleagues or friends or family members as being like really staunch gun owners, but when you hear about why they own guns and what it does for them, how they use them, how they protect themselves, how they keep safe, it helps to provide context to this issue, and it helps to make it feel less red and blue of an issue.
Absolutely. And arm yourself with resources in your community.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I mentioned the Bullet Points Project. Have that at hand, right? Mm-hmm. Find out if there is a police-sponsored gun amnesty mm-hmm. program. Find out, and this will sound crazy, but find out if there are gun ranges mm-hmm. in your community that provides storage.
Mm-hmm.
We find that when the gun club, right, or the gun range, the shooting range, has storage, people join that club or that group, mm-hmm. they are far less likely to take that weapon home, because then it's just a pain, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have the weapon where they're going to use the weapon, right, mm-hmm. as opposed to in the house and maybe mm-hmm. haven't put it away and whatnot.
Yeah.
Get your, because most physicians are employed now, right?
Yeah.
Get your hospital, your healthcare system to offer these very inexpensive gun locks, right? That are just available, mm-hmm. right? So there's no stigma attached to mm-hmm. asking for or to receiving one.
Yeah.
They're just out there like condoms are out there. Mm-hmm. It's no big thing.
Yeah. Now, for a lot of people who are thinking more of gun ownership as like a sport or like a pastime, right, the safety measures that a gun club or shooting range goes through, as opposed to, you know, the safety measures that you might do at the house, like the people that run those gun clubs and those shooting ranges, they have to have like a lot of insurance, and that requires a lot of very specific rules and policies. And so one, you know, it's easier for you to make sure that you're safe. And two, it makes it more of a community thing as opposed to an isolating thing. So it can be a conversation about lifestyle. So especially like maybe that patient talks about maybe, oh, I have been feeling depressed lately. No, I don't feel like self-harm, but I'm feeling really isolated. And then there's this other sort of like thing that could potentially be seen as an additional threat factor. You can say, hey, like, have you tried engaging in your local like gun community? Like perhaps you can find some new peer groups, some new socializing, and it might help this other thing that I know that you say that you're struggling with.
And you can ask questions about, you know, well, maybe for now it's better to store the gun offsite, right? Yeah. Or it's better to store the gun in a certain way, mm-hmm. Separate from the ammo, separate from et cetera, yeah. et cetera, so that it's not a spur of the moment action or decision,
yeah.
To do something such as suicide.
Yeah.
There are ways to have these conversations without saying, I'm going to turn you in, you shouldn't have a gun, et cetera, right?
Yeah. you know, and yeah, well, like I said, I think we've kind of hit the nail, like this nail on the head many times. I think it's fully in the board, but like we recognize this is not an easy issue, but by thinking about it, contextualizing what it means for you, what it means for your patients, especially in the populations that you're hoping to serve, in the geographic areas that you plan to practice as a future practitioner in, it's going to help you think about how to make this conversation feel more like, I just want to make sure that like you're doing this in the best possible, most safe way possible.
Right.
And, you know, again, meeting patients where they're at.
Without bias, mm-hmm. without your positionality and your ideologies that coming into play. Yeah. It's all about that very fine line that healthcare providers have to walk between recognizing autonomy and providing beneficence. Mm-hmm. This is simply one of those exercises. Mm-hmm. And arguably, I say you can achieve both. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. But especially in our environment, meaning mm-hmm. the United States environment, there is a role for physicians. And there's a role for being an effective physician mm-hmm. without alienating your patients, without undermining the trust that should exist, but really maximizing autonomy and trying to maximize beneficence.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything in this conversation that we've missed that you can think of? I want to make sure that we're providing a well-balanced, in-depth discussion because I want people on sort of all sides of this conversation to feel like they have action steps and that they have things to think about and consider, because it's not a one-size-fits-all approach to any of this.
Absolutely. And I think that it begins with assessing your own positionality first, mm-hmm. right? And I do think that providers, not only do I think, I know, providers have their own ideals and moral compass and rights, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe you're a healthcare provider who owns guns, right?
Yeah.
That might give you even a stronger position of discussion point with your patients, even if you're a provider who does not own guns. Maybe going to gun training, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe going deeper into the notion of gun ownership will help you empathize or see patients who have a different positionality than you do, mm-hmm. Can be helpful.
Yeah.
It all benefits your relationship with your patients. Mm-hmm. And I hope that this conversation has provided some tools to people mm-hmm. and some opportunity for thought for folks going into healthcare. Mm-hmm. It's doable.
Yeah.
We've done it before. You and I know, John.
Yeah.
And this should be no different.
Yeah.
And it's really about a skill set more than anything.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, like, as providers, you cannot control the rules of the government. You can certainly do advocacy work, but there's very real human beings on the other side of this issue. And you can either choose to serve all of your patients really well, regardless of their stance on this, or you can provide unbalanced care.
Great.
That's a choice you can make. It's not one I would hope you would make, but it's a choice you can make. And like, you know, that sort of self-reflection that you talk about on your positionality, understanding where your thoughts and notions are coming from. Where is the source of your perspective originating? And where is the source of other people's perspective originating? Right? You know, part of like my doctoral work has been in rural sociology. And so like understanding how culturally things work differently in sort of these spaces and places gives us a lot of insight into like why there is this like cultural difference. And especially anybody that wants to do rural care, like having a hard line on this in one way or another alienates part of your patient population, because people come down, like you said, on either side of this line very harshly. And so being able to say like, no, I have no guns in the home is like, okay, great. And then if it's like, hey, I have guns in the home, but they're safely stored and locked away. Great. Cool.
Right.
You know, it's intervening where you can make a difference.
Right. And it's also,
it's harm reduction.
Right. It's also knowing where to plant yourself, yeah. Right? Both in terms of specialty mm-hmm. and in terms of locus, right?
Yeah.
So if I had a hardline position, either for or against, you know, firearms, mm-hmm. if maybe I would decide I don't want to be a primary care physician, maybe I would decide, or emergency room physician, maybe I would decide, oh, I don't want to work in an urban area, you know, mm-hmm. inner city urban area, often where academic medical centers are located, mm-hmm. or a very rural area, right? Maybe I'm better suited in a suburban setting, right? Yeah. So make decisions first that are right for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, you'll help make decisions that are right for your patients.
Yeah. All right. So folks, I hope that you've sort of gained something helpful, right? A big part of this conversation has been, and I hope you picked up on this, to meet your patients where they're at. Telling a patient that they are categorically wrong alienates them, not just from you, but from future care. In a profession where the smallest thing can push people away, we don't want anything large separating some of our most vulnerable from receiving and accessing care, right? We want our spaces to feel welcoming and open to patients regardless of their lived experiences. That's what medicine should be. It's what healthcare should be. It's what dentistry should be. It's what podiatry, optometry, no matter your health profession, we are providers for everyone, and that's part of who we are. So I hope that this was an engaging conversation. If you'd like to talk further about it, I'm sure that if you hit Dr. Meckel up, that she would absolutely love to have that chat. I'm happy to chat about it, but my background, much more limited, turns out, than Dr. Meckel. So I might bring her in or refer you over. But, you know, this is a conversation to be had. This is not a thing that, like, you listen to this podcast and now you get to check it off your list. It's something that will move forward, which is what all these ethics episodes are about.
Exactly.
So we'll see you next week on the Pre-Health Podcast at Penn State. Pre-Health Podcast at Penn State is a production of the Pre-Health Advising Office and the Everly College of Science at Penn State. It is produced, edited, and promoted by the Pre-Health Advising Team. The views, opinions, and advice shared during this podcast are that of the hosts and any guests only, and do not necessarily reflect the best advice for every student at every institution or for every health profession. This is a nonprofit podcast made for the purpose of better serving pre-health students across our university system. Our intro music is This Science from Coma Media, and our outro music is Screening, also by Coma Media.